And it is time once again for Senior Moments on KVON.
This is Senior Moments on KVON 1440.
Proudly brought to you by the Queen of the Valley Medical Center and Community Benefit. In collaboration with Community Action of Napa Valley as a Leadership Napa Valley project.
And this time around for Senior Moments, we're happy to welcome to the studio Dr. Robert Albanese, who is the medical director for geriatric psychiatry at St. Helena Hospital. Did I get your name pronounced correctly?
You did great. Thank you.
Okay. All right. First time out, not too bad. And the title was correct as well?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. So let's get started. And first question, let's talk about your background and training. You are a psychiatrist. Where did you study for that?
I got my medical degree from East Carolina University in North Carolina. It's part of the University of North Carolina system. And I did my residency training. I did a combined residency in internal medicine and psychiatry at the University of Virginia, and became board certified in both internal medicine and psychiatry, which is still the case, and was board certified for a time in what was then called psychosomatics, which is a combination of internal medicine and psychiatry, essentially. So.
And how long have you been with St. Helena Hospital?
Just over a year. My wife and I had always dreamed of living in the wine country, and so we finally made it happen. So,
again, welcome in.
Thank you.
So let's talk about some of the issues. In a general sense, do older people, geriatric patients, have a different set of issues in terms of mental health compared to younger people?
Sure. Now, for the most part, I think our patients... the main difference is that they have a longer tenure with their illness. So let's say, for example, we have a patient who has a history of depression, you know, and they're in their 70s, they may have had more episodes than someone who's younger. Another important difference is the burden of medical comorbidity. So they're more likely to have, let's say, heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, elevated serum cholesterol, and a number of general medical issues that can weave themselves into their psychiatric health as well. So those are the primary differences. Another one that's a difference is the onset of what we now call neurocognitive disorders. When a patient begins to develop Alzheimer's, for example, it may present as a depression or a mania or what we would call a psychosis, which is essentially a break with reality, paranoia, for example. So these are things that we deal with that are unique to the geriatric patients.
Interesting. Are there conditions that are onset at an older age? I know typically we think of... The psychotic episodes or the tendency to have psychosis is something that can develop in teenagers and young adults, may not be seen early, doesn't typically develop later in life, I don't think, right?
That's correct. In fact, one of the most important clues that something other than a primary psychiatric disorder is happening is a patient who in his or her 60s, 70s, 80s suddenly develops psychiatric symptoms and has never had them before. So late onset is generally unusual, and it prompts us to look for another cause. The majority of our patients are patients who have a tenure with their mental illness, but we do get those with late onset. And then, like I said, we look for something else going on.
Mm-hmm. So in a general way, again, do you find that modern psychiatry is focused more on talk therapy or more on medications today?
Well, that's an important question, because in the inpatient setting especially, the emphasis is definitely on medication. Now, before I came here about a little over a year ago, I was at the Menninger Clinic in Houston, and that was a clinic that was synonymous with American psychiatry for decades. And at the Menninger, it's still primarily a psychotherapy hospital, but the length of stay is rather long, and the patients essentially pay out of pocket. So the emphasis is on medications in today's inpatient setting, in outpatient as well, from a psychiatric point of view. Outpatient, it's important to know that that there are many highly skilled social workers and psychologists who are very good at psychotherapy. So psychiatrists tend to focus more on medications in the outpatient setting, even though they're trained to do psychotherapy, and many still do. But in the inpatient setting, definite emphasis on medications mm-hmm. because they work and they work fast.
And what medications currently are the ones you find work the best?
Well,
I know it depends on conditions, but
So the antipsychotics are very effective. The newer generation of antipsychotics are very good for mood. In fact, I would say at least 90% of the patients who take those have a mood condition. And, you know, on television you can see ads for Abilify, for example, mm-hmm. for depression. So they're very helpful. Antidepressants are very good as well. Lithium is an old standby, but an amazing medication. It was actually the first medication discovered that was discovered to specifically help a psychiatric disorder back in 1948. So I think all of them are pretty effective. All of them could have a significant downside. I think the days of using the benzodiazepine class long-term has sort of waned now. There are concerns about those medications used long-term, so we try to use those short-term. Mm-hmm. Without singling out specific medications, I can think of one that's clearly better than others, and this is for the psychosis, you know, the patients with schizophrenia or a related condition called schizoaffective disorder. Clozapine or Clozaril is known to be superior to the other antipsychotics, but it requires frequent monitoring of blood counts, weekly for the first 6 months to a year, and then every other week thereafter. Mm-hmm. So it's a great medication, but it also has a downside. Mm-hmm. A lot of patients gain weight on it, and so we try to stay on top of that by weighing the patient frequently and giving them consultation with a dietitian and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Are these in the, if I get the terminology right, the serotonin reuptake inhibitors? Is that what we're talking about? Did I get that right?
So that's an important class of antidepressants, is the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And they're also really good for anxiety, although when you take them for anxiety, you don't notice an effect immediately. It tends to take several weeks to get a sufficient blood level to have a noticeable difference with anxiety. But they're primarily used for anxiety and depression, panic disorder, and they are very effective, and they work by increasing the activity of serotonin in the brain. There's an associated class, SNRIs, whose use is very similar to that of SSRIs, anxiety, depression, panic disorder. They have a reputation for being good in chronic pain as well. And then some of the newer antipsychotics actually work by blocking a specific type of serotonin receptor, but that's rather specific. So, but SSRIs are, Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Lexapro, Celexa are the main ones there.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, you're adjusting the chemical balance in the brain.
Exactly. Right? That's what we're doing, yes.
How does it get out of whack in the first place?
Oh, another great question. I think, the brain is an organ like all others, and it works better when it's given a healthy milieu, So a healthy lifestyle is one really important thing that people can do. Very judicious use of alcohol, avoid tobacco, manage stress, be a good steward of your emotional resources, exercise regularly. These are all things that help brain function. Other things that are known to cause dysregulation in brain chemistry is other substance use besides alcohol. We have a lot of methamphetamine use here in California, and that causes all manner of psychiatric symptoms. Even something as relatively benign as cannabis can produce important psychiatric symptoms in patients who are predisposed. So medical illnesses in general, there are certain conditions like hypothyroidism, for example, that can contribute to depression. I guess, you know, probably diet plays a role, but that's not as well studied. So,
does there seem to be any kind of cumulative effect over a lifetime where that imbalance develops? Is it, you know, acute or chronic, I guess, maybe in the medical terms?
I think some patients are sort of acute and some are sort of chronic intermittent. And I think it's one of the important variable dimensions of the illnesses, you know. And I think it's probably true that if we take patients who, you know, have depression or bipolar disorder and we get them living a really healthy lifestyle, I believe that patient's outcomes will be better, that patient will have a more benign course. You know, it's not well studied, but I believe that to be the case.
Mm-hmm. We're talking on Senior Moments today with Dr. Robert Albanese, who is Medical Director for Geriatric Psychiatry at St. Lena Hospital. And obviously the focus is on mental health with older adults and conditions and treatment responsive to that. Outside of the medical prescription realm, when I asked about talk therapy and those kind of things, is there any difference with older people in those areas? I mean, you get to a certain age, you've kind of, you know, chewed through a lot of life and you've had ups and downs and you've talked through and had problems and solved them or not solved them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and your perspective is different at 60 or 70 or 80 than it was at 20, 30 or 40, right?
Yes. So I think that the biggest difference is that in most cases, the elderly patient, the life experience gives them a certain amount of flexibility, resilience. And I think that they may have a slight edge against the younger patients in terms of coping with those disorders. On the other hand, a heavy burden of medical illness can have the opposite effect. Can lead to a certain amount of despair. I don't know of any difference in the modes of therapy, though, between the younger and the older patients. You know, and I have to admit that in my career, there's definitely been an emphasis on medications. So although I can do psychotherapy, it's not a part of my daily routine usually. So,
Some people take an antidepressant, for example, for a specific period of time. It's not expected to be a lifetime of it. Is that also true with older patients?
Generally so. Now, the rule that I use, I think is the most common rule, is that if a patient develops a depression and they've never had one before, we treat them for a year and then reassess. If the patient has had numerous episodes of depression, we may recommend that they stay on the medications continuously from then on. And by the way, speaking of psychotherapy is an important alternative or addition to medication in some patients. So some patients with depression, for example, or anxiety disorders, panic disorder, respond really well to certain types of psychotherapy. And for the patients who want to avoid medications, and I endorse this, you know, if they can find a therapist and do that instead, it tends to work pretty well. For diseases like bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, which is sort of a hybrid between those two, generally speaking, while therapy can be helpful, medications are necessary.
Mm-hmm. I would think it must get complicated at times. I'm sure it is for all patients, but when people are older, they're taking medications for physical conditions. They are, like you say, maybe don't have the best health regimens. Maybe they're not eating well and consistently and so on. And then you mix in psychiatric issue or some kind of cognitive issue, knowing how to define what it is that's going on with a person when they're not acting like themselves suddenly. What kind of testing is done? It's not like for medical conditions where it's just a blood test or something, right?
So testing that's specific to what we do probably consists mostly of doing cognitive testing. So we do quite a bit of that. You know, we have puzzles that we have the patients do, and we look at the results. We do a lot of brain imaging. Now, that's done in other areas as well, but for us, it can help us understand what's going on with a patient. So we do a fair amount of that. We do get labs. For example, one thing that we're kind of interested in is like a B12 level. You know, some people can't absorb B12 very easily. And so when B12 levels get low, cyanocobalamin it's called, then patients may have psychiatric symptoms. So we wind up supplementing patients with B12. I would say probably 10% of our patients wind up
really
getting a supplementation with B12.
I've heard in a general way B12 will make you feel better if you take a supplement or something or get a shot, right?
I guess if you felt badly because the level was low, I don't know if kind of adding on to a normal level would be helpful. But we wind up doing that quite a bit. We routinely check for syphilis, and that's not something that we see a lot of. In fact, I haven't seen it since I've gotten here, but a brain infection with syphilis can cause all manner of psychiatric symptoms. So we routinely test for that. And even though, you know, I think some patients probably would feel stigmatized by that, but it is an important thing to discover if it's present, you know, and that's one of the things it's rare, but it's one of the things we look for in patients who have late onset psychiatric symptoms, like we were discussing before. So,
because it's true, you can have syphilis and not know it.
Absolutely.
For decades.
You can. And, so, you know, we get blood counts, for example, and one of the things I'm really interested in is what size are the red blood cells? What's the platelet count? Is the patient anemic? You know, these are all things that can give us information about how well the patient is. For example, you know, alcohol is really important to both physical and mental health, and if people are drinking excessively, they won't always tell you. But you can look at routine labs and get a strong clue that there's an issue there. The platelet count may be low, the red blood cells may be enlarged, their liver enzymes might be elevated. And so sometimes you have to use those clues because not everyone discloses those things for a number of reasons. And so we do get, low serum sodium is a problem we frequently encounter, can cause patients to get confused. So we use the normal sorts of labs, but maybe sometimes for different reasons.
I think maybe one of the most important questions, we're getting short on time, but for people listening, when is the time when you should reach out to a doctor versus trying to talk someone through what they're experiencing? We're focused on seniors here, and in many cases, you have caregivers who know this person. They're a parent, grandparent, family member. They've known them for a long time. They see changes in that person, but you're attributing it to aging and just natural changes that occur, as opposed to something is wrong now, something that wasn't there before is wrong. How do we know when it's the time to reach out to a psychiatrist, to a mental health professional, versus just a physical issue? Or just natural effects of aging? What should we look for?
Well, I think you sort of hit on one important element is a change in personality, especially if it's relatively rapid. That's something that all of us are interested in, especially psychiatrists and neurologists, but also general medical doctors, you know. We are very interested in someone who says that they want to harm themselves or they wish they were dead, for example. That's something that we want to act on. This is not nearly as common in patients with psychiatric disorders, but sometimes a manifestation of a psychiatric disorder would be voicing a desire to hurt other people. And then we also have this category called gravely disabled. You know, if somebody just can't take care of their daily needs, That's something that needs to be investigated. So I think those are the most important ones. Change in personality, danger to self, danger to others, or just being non-functional, mm-hmm. and that being a departure from their baseline. Mm-hmm.
What about withdrawing? There's a lot of that that happens with older people. You can have a loss of sense of purpose. You don't feel needed anymore, and you sort of just recede. You know, is that just natural, or does that indicate a problem?
Well, it's a stressor. It's natural to some extent, but we used to have a term we used called involutional depression. We applied it primarily. This was in the days when it was traditional for men to work and women to stay home. And so the men would retire and then get depressed because they would lose their purpose and their meaning in life, just as you said. Some patients, it's a transient thing and they get used to it, but some it can be the first stressor that precipitates a depressive episode. And so, definitely that's something that, would require the attention of a physician, mm-hmm. and maybe a referral to a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, very good. And we've talked on this program many times about the many organizations that are available for people to reach out through. And I think everybody knows what they need to know about that, just a question of when and what to be aware of going forward in those older years. Senior Moments program this week featuring Dr. Robert Albanese, Medical Director for Geriatric Psychiatry at the St. Helena Hospital. And thanks for being on Senior Moments this week.
Thanks for having me.
A lot of good information.